widely pointed directly at you. Of everything I've done in my career, selling hops to brewers is the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
I believe you. And I have a lot to say why it's so hard for small brewers.
So just
I totally get it.
Absolutely ridiculous. That's, I think, a bigger hurdle than any technical challenge that faces any small scale hop brewer.
Yeah. And it's a technical challenge, and it's also a 9 times out of 10, probably more than 9 times out of 10, it's not in their wheelhouse to be a salesperson. They're getting into this because they're a grower, they're a farmer, they're good at that.
Right.
And that was a big part of the Charter Grower Program for us, was that we said, we will help you grow. Let us worry about the selling part, because we know you don't want to do that. And again, 9 times out of 10, they'd say, thank God, here, just take these, take these.
And I'm not I've had lots and lots of sales training, because as part of my field research, I was always interacting with farmers, and usually larger corporate scale farmers. So I was always trying to sell as well, but that's not my wheelhouse. I'm a tech guy, right? So I took what I knew was a strong point and something I could sell to brewers as a value add to help me get in the door.
Right.
So that's what small scale growers need to look at, is what is your niche? What is it that you do better than anybody else or can? And how does that fit in with your vision for growing hops? And sometimes it doesn't.
No, that is absolutely correct. Because the biggest problem for me, and I'm a small brewer, so I should be able to accommodate these small growers more maybe than the bigger breweries. But my problem is, let alone for having some supply left on a hop contract, but like, let alone for that. Which I've even stopped doing. So eventually that will run out. But I don't think within North Carolina, the ones that I've talked to, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure no one pelletizes.
Uh-huh.
And that's a problem for me.
Yep.
I can't just throw all those hops into my half barrel co-pilot system or my 3-barrel batch. Like, I can't. I just can't do that.
Yep.
And so, I mean, that's a deal breaker.
But yep, absolutely.
That's a deal breaker. And that's unfortunate, because I know how hard it is, like the investment to get a pelletizer and all that. I just don't see how you can survive without having a pelletizer, unless growing hops is just one little piece of what you're doing.
You can't.
On the farm. You can't.
At end of the day, you can't.
This local producer who has a farm, they're great guys, but I just can't do anything with whole leaf hops.
Send them out to be pelletized. If he needs contacts that'll do it on a small scale, let me know.
Right. And I know, talking with that specific grower, that was one of the things he said. He has a pelletizer, but he was like, I'm never going to be able to have a product lower in cost than like YCH
That's
or someplace
okay.
like that.
That's
and
okay.
it's, but yeah. it's, so, you know, he doesn't, he has that, and it's going to be a local kind of product, mm-hmm. but there isn't, you don't always get the people like Rachel who understand that creating a local supply chain or supporting that local supply chain is important in and of itself. And that means that it's naturally going to cost a little bit more, sure. but where is the bottom line? You know, where does it actually affect what cost of that pint is
yep.
actually affected by that?
And what you could get away with, like there are breweries that will spin that, like Noda, for example. They will, like, they do that with the Carolina malt supply with their malt company, and
mm-hmm.
not, and that, but you're right, at a certain scale of economy it becomes too much, and a bigger brewery is going to do that. But like, I would totally switch everything and buy all local hops if they were pelletized. Like, there's no other barrier for me, unless it was
garbage. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I would like to specifically ask you about that. And I know I put that in our notes.
$20 a pound isn't going to work, but
right.
I will pay the same as I do for, you know, 15, you know, like four, depending on the hop.
Right.
You know,
most small growers, Rachel, don't know what it costs them to grow.
Yeah.
They have no idea. Mm-hmm. So they set a price and I say, what's that price based on?
But probably just other people's prices.
Yeah. They're like, well, this is, you know, I want to get as much for it as I can. Right. I'm like, okay, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
Right.
What does it cost you to grow? Well, I don't know. I'm just small. Even more important to know
right.
what it costs you
right.
to grow. What do you have in it? Or I don't count my labor. Okay.
Well, that's a lot of business owners everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
That's why I was like, I could do this.
Yeah. Okay,
and
Jen, what were you going to ask?
Yeah.
Me?
So I will say one thing that I can add to that definitely is within the guild, obviously because of things like antitrust regulations, when people, it was always a challenge because somebody would say, I don't know how to price my product, you know, in like our community forum. And I would have to come in and say, you can't ask that here.
Right.
This is, you know, we can't discuss setting prices. That's illegal. But there were a lot of people who were like, I don't know how to price my product. And you could call another maltster, but the, you know, that maltster may have been in business for 5 years. They right. may be in a completely different area. And then, you know, a lot of times what we would tell them is talk to your local homebrew store owners or your local suppliers and find out what they're paying for things and then back your way into it. But with hops specifically, Southeastern hops. Mm-hmm. I know NC State has a hop breeding program.
Yep.
There is a brewery in Etowah that I was at a few months ago. It's called Sideways Farm Brewery. And they have about 9 acres. And it is very much a farm brewery, but they are growing some of the hops for the NC State, some of the varieties that are coming out of NC State. I'm trying to think of like, and I have not tried the hops. I cannot attest to their quality or their flavor, but
right.
traditionally one of the first things you learn about hops is hops only grow best between certain parallels. I also say that coming from the malt and barley world where people said you can't grow barley in North Carolina. You can't grow barley in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And they are, and it's getting better. Mm-hmm. It's not what people are used to.
Right.
And it, for me specifically, barley grown in the Southeast has a very particular flavor to it. It's not mm-hmm. good. It's not bad. I can just pick it up that mm-hmm. this is like, okay, this is some like winter two row barley from somewhere in the Southeast. Mm-hmm. So translating that to hops, how are those hops programs, the breeding programs for non-traditional areas, what they're producing, what is your opinion on those? And it's kind of a loaded question, but
anytime anybody says, James, what is your opinion? It's like, all right, put the seatbelt on because right. here we go.
Or I guess maybe discuss, this is a little more diplomatic, discuss some okay. of the challenges that you face when you're trying to create a hop breeding program in an area where hops don't grow well.
Right. So this is my cue to get alcohol.
Yeah. yep. So let's talk about the regionality thing. In the last 10 years, we are learning more about how hops behave in quote non-traditional growing regions than we have in the history of human species. So to say that hops don't grow in Florida is a misnomer. They absolutely do grow in Florida. Mm-hmm. Well, hops don't, you're not going to get a harvest. Yes, you will. Hops will flower in Florida. So people say, well, great, I'm going to send it. Don't do it, Florida. Don't do it. Or they'll say, well, why don't I just grow in a greenhouse? And one of the things I like to say is you can do whatever you want. Drives Greg bananas. But that's just my snarky comment of being like, you know what? I'm not even going to bother. It's sort of like Rachel be like, you're not worth my time.
Yeah.
So
I don't need you well, actually.
Right. Yeah. So I think the biggest challenge is in breeding hops for areas that are non-traditional and you have basically no long-term record of this plant's horticulture. What are you breeding for? How do you know what to breed for? So if we say, okay, 10 years to bring a variety to market, that is, and frankly, the marketability aspect is like the last thing. In the last attribute in that step that you're testing for. So that means 9 years and probably 1,000 or 2,000 plus generations. How do you know what to breed for? And so when I hear those comments of, oh yeah, you know, we're, you know, NC State's, breeding their own hop based on what? Mm-hmm. What attributes are we brewing? Are we doing it? Are we doing it because we need our own hop because that's going to give us an identity and that's how we're going to really put our foothold in the marketplace? No, I think that's absolutely wrong. To link that back to your first question about, you know, how do smaller non-traditional regional growers compete without having a sexy variety? You need a full-blown, honest-to-God, pay-somebody marketing cooperative. Mm-hmm. Period. Mm-hmm. because the only way you're going to get any headway into the industry is having someone who's always in Rachel's face, right? Here you go. This is who we are. We are serious. We can get you what you need. And that takes money from the group, from a true marketing cooperative. And Greg and I have an episode on co-ops. It's like, is it a co-op or a club? Mm-hmm. Because most of these grower groups, and even though we've got a couple of hopnologists in the New York region that are part of those groups, and say, guys, you're running a club. Mm-hmm. You all get together, you all sort of pay your dues, and you get together and you talk about your hop issues. But what you really need to do is put your serious money into a traditional marketing cooperative for a specialty crop and start making headway into the marketing space for those brewers, mm-hmm. period. And
that's, it's like, it costs so much money to do that. It's like, what's the best way to make $1 million is probably to spend $1 billion doing it.
You don't have to, it's true. It can take a lot of money, but frankly, and we look at hop growing, and we thought very erroneously, very early on with our charter grower program, that if you were going to spend 10 grand just on infrastructure for an acre of hops, you were incentivized to perform. Wrong. Nope. People will drop 10, 15, 20 grand if they think they can buy their way into success. Mm-hmm. Easy peasy. And there's nothing further from the truth. Yeah, marketing co-ops do take serious money to start up. But there's also serious money available in the form of grants in every state in the U.S., for specialty crops. It's called the Specialty Crop Block Grant. And part of that is for specifically this. And when I talk about money, I'm talking hundreds of thousands of dollars to set up.
Right.
And write a grant proposal. And there you go. That's how one can get started doing that. Then once the money flows in from sales and, you know, all that kind of stuff, then you can help support that, because now the growers can see that they can actually grow more because they have a market. So now they can pay more into a cooperative. And so that's how it works. But you're right. You do need seed money.
And that is interesting that with hops, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not as familiar with hops as I am with barley and malt, mm-hmm. but you know, hearing something about the marketing cooperative, I have in different regions, and I won't call anybody out specifically, but in different regions, you know, the maltsters in particular are competing for the same customers, and they can professionally get along if they're in a room together, but there's no way in hell they're going to work with each other, which is where something like a guild, you know, comes into play. But of course we can do marketing as, you know, craft malt, the product, not the individual people, but needing kind of that regionality that, you know, the growers could potentially do something like that. But then the maltsters are the processors. And that's a lot of where the story comes in. So are a lot of hop growers also processing their same products, or is there kind of like a hopster, kind of like a maltster?
Not really. There's some folks that tried, but there's just not enough volume to justify it. Right. So most hop growers who are getting into processing, and processing being defined as post-drying, so pelletizing, changing its form mm-hmm. into a food product, that's usually very small scale individuals doing that. They may do some contract work here or there, like for some of your growers in North Carolina or Virginia that don't have access to pellets, you know, fee for service kind of thing.
I will say I've had hops offered to me by like U.S. food, mm-hmm. and that's weird.
Yep.
As a brewer, no.
Yeah. Yep. We see it.
I'm going to go to Joe Schmo down the street and get his holy pots before I'm going to buy your pellets off the U.S. food truck.
Right.
I just don't want it. That's so weird.
That's kind of like if McDonald's had beer. It would be like, okay, that's fine, and there's a market for it, but.
Right. Or, you know, auto dealerships selling personal protective equipment in the era of COVID. You're like, really? Why am I getting Don Miller Ford advertisements for nitrile gloves? What the hell?
Yeah. Why? Yeah. You are not the authority.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know how to be rude about this, but why do you have hops?
Yeah, right. Yep. Yep. But I think that if we look at, just to stay on the co-op thing for just a little longer, the here in Wisconsin, the, you know, we grow over half of the world's cranberries here, and it's in one narrow band in the state. And so there's, you know, probably 50 or 60 players in that space, six or seven of them that are large enough to, you know, muscle their way around. And they're the same way. They're perfectly, you know, cordial to one another when they're in the same room or at a convention or conference, but they're like cats in a sack because they, I don't understand why. Well, I do understand why. That's not true. Yeah. I understand why, because from their perspective, they believe that these other people are the ones that are, you know, edging it on their market and they have to compete with them. Mm-hmm. But also you've got these growers that have been doing it for three and four generations. And, you know, that grower over there is an asshole because he did something to my granddaddy years ago. Right. So you've got that sort of thing going on too. But for hop growers, non-traditional hop growers, there's none of that, right? It's so brand new. There's none of that. So state to state, it's a little bit different. Some states collaborate, the growers collaborate, you know, talk, they've got nothing to hide. Here in Wisconsin, I don't know what it is. But everybody thinks as a grower, they've got the secret and they're not going to share any information with anybody. And, yep. And Michigan was the same way. Michigan hop growers were the same way. They're not going to, not going to say anything about their yield numbers. They're not going to say anything about their quality or their alphas, blah, 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 because they think they're going to let the cat out of the bag. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know what? Go ahead.
And I was going to say, I mean, the market out there, it's so dominated by the Pacific Northwest from a hop perspective that there is so much room for the little guys to play if they all can get their marketing and their quality game up.
Right.
And doing that together as a group is the only way it's going to work.
Yeah, they're right. the Hop Growers of America, for a couple of years, they entertained the non-traditional hop growers and started the Stonewall Side Guild for them, and which was... I was definitely not for that. They were placating them. You know, like, just go over there and play a little bit. And they even, you know, like, hey, we're going to have this, you know, small track at our national conference, which was huge. And I was out there and Dan was out there and we talked, we got some good exposure, but the traditional hop growers, were just a nuisance. I mean, they're just like, they were nothing to them.
Yes.
So nor are they, is that group incentivized to help the non-traditional hop grower? So your growers, if you're listening, you're left to your own devices.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I know with the guild, like we definitely, that was always kind of a source of constant frustration is the industrial maltsters. And they're all, you know, wonderful people, personally, professionally, they're all very nice, but it mm-hmm. was always just kind of a pat on the head. And yes, yeah, you guys are really doing something different. That's cool. But, you know, that the research money isn't behind developing flavor in barley.
Nope. Because
customers don't want that, right? Most the traditional barley growing, who you're growing the barley for, flavor is the enemy. You know, it's homogenization is what they want.
Even the research dollars that are available for new hop varieties coming out of the USDA at Corvallis, mm-hmm. it's all bred for the Pacific Northwest environment.
Right.
And so the small scale hop grower says, hey, great, you know, in non-traditional areas, North Carolina, Virginia, wherever it happens to be in the Southeast, I'm going to get access to these great new varieties, but you put them in down there and they don't grow for shit because they weren't bred for that environment.
Right. Right.
Because, exactly. Well, but this is kind of out of the public breeding program. I'm like, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. It did. Yeah.
So do not bank as a grower in your regions, do not bank on breeding to save your bacon because it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know with the guild, we kicked open some doors to, you know, to get invited to conferences, to get invited to speak, where it was, you know, knowing we had somebody on our board who's maybe a past president of the ASBC, mm-hmm. having him specifically email the organizers and them saying like, yeah, that would be great if you wanted to come talk. And he's like, oh, no, not me. This person. Too late. We already accepted.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just... making people pay attention.
Yep. I'm kind of well known for that and getting in people's faces, certainly on the technical aspects, because I'm like, show me the data. Right. And it's probably why I don't get invited back to the Hop Growers of America anymore. Just starting to put these two things together here. I'm not well liked.
There was a bit of you're giving him a microphone, really? You know, when this all started.
For New England IPAs, on the science side, all the arguments and conversations about biotransformation and Hop Creek and all right, what's your take? Is there really,
let me put my science hat on.
I need science. Why this is bullshit.
Okay, science hat is on.
I like it.
Very nice.
This is when I start calling him out for making words up.
Right.
So like basically, Fitch, break it down for our listeners. Why is everyone in a hoo-ha about it? Why is it such a big deal? Is there really some sort of scientific reason why this makes it better?
Magic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And or is it a bunch of, you know, I need a reason to back up my theory kind of?
So yes with an if, no with a but. Biotransformation is a thing. Right. That we heavily relied on in the history of brewing anything. We've just come to have to appreciate, I think, in the last even 5 years, that it's a thing that actually has a much bigger impact on consistency than what anybody really ever appreciated. It was part of the dark art of brewing. Right. It's that I tell my Siebel students, I was like, you know, I think brewing is about 60% science, 40% art. And maybe it's 60% art, 40% science, but either way, there's things that we know intrinsically that in a biological system, the variables are so huge that we can't always write an equation for it. So we have to appreciate that it's there. But we can't quantify what's going to happen because there's just too many variables. And biotransformation is one of those things. Unfortunately, what's happening now in the research space is that that's exactly what we're trying to do with like things like aromazyme and whatnot, where you're saying, oh, hey, we know that in the beer, we have these aroma-bound glutamates that if we go in and we make this cleave through hydrolysis with this special enzyme, it's going to release all this bound linalool you didn't know you had. Yep, you know what? So is aging. So it's not a new thing. And I would even argue that it's not necessarily a controllable thing. You're tossing in this particular instance, mm-hmm. you're tossing in an enzyme. You're giving it a space to work. But in order to calculate what's going to come off the back end, you got to know what the feedstock is, what's going in the front end. And have you done that analysis?
Right. No,
you haven't. So what do you expect to get out the back end? This is the point in class at Siebel. I'd like you go stand in the corner, which I have done before. I have made, and they're like, what? Really? I'm like, yeah, go stand in the corner. So that's biotransformation. Yes, it's a real thing.
Sure.
We know there are some pathways that we can track with a very high degree of confidence for around the aroma, the big aroma compounds, nerol and citronellol and all those sorts of things where, yeah, you put in hops during primary fermentation expecting that you're going to get a bunch of citronellol out of it and actually the yeast chew it up and spit out nerol on the back end. You're like, what the hell happened? Mm-hmm. Science.
No one even knows that because they don't even know what they're tasting. Like these brewers, they just throw it in. There's no, I mean, they taste harsh.
Yep. That's astringency coming from polyphenols, most likely. Especially when you overload the system. And those polyphenols being water soluble, they're going to just keep soaking out and soaking out and soaking out of the system as opposed to some of these other aroma compounds that are, some of them are water soluble, but there is a carrying limit in the beer for those compounds. And the more you add, you're not going to get those compounds out, but you will continue to suck those polyphenols out, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to hit your upper limit on some of these aroma profiles, but then your polyphenols are just going to keep going. And then you end up with this thing that tastes like turpentine.
Mm-hmm. What is your max amount of dry hop per barrel to make depends a good IPA?
An IPA?
Yeah, well, yeah, just like the max.
You're asking the wrong guy. He's gonna say zero.
Not true. I enjoy IPAs, well made, well balanced IPAs. The trouble is, they're hard to find right now.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, growing up in the brewing world, if you will, I was taught, you know, no more than 2 pounds per barrel.
Like that's too much.
That's too much. I actually
only from a dry hop perspective.
What we do is 1 pound per barrel.
So for you're talking total hop usage or dry hopping?
Dry hopping.
In a, let's say a moderate gravity beer, because that, this whole, if I give you a number, there are people going to be like, yeah, but what if it goes into this beer? When are you going to shut up, John?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. So, well, the reason I bring it up is because I want people to hear, like, these breweries are doing 6, 7, 8 pounds per barrel. It's ridiculous.
Let's go with what the data say, right? The data show unequivocally in a pale ale with moderate gravity, 5.5% alcohol content, that beer is not going to absorb any more than 1.6 pounds per barrel, period, from an extraction rate.
Come out of my pocket.
Period.
Yeah.
End of the day, take it to the bank. And as a matter of fact, at room temperature, that extraction is done in 12 hours.
Yeah.
Boom. Get the frickin' hops off of it, because the longer it sits, the more polyphenols you're going to start pulling off of that. Now, if you have a really malty beer and you've got a higher gravity, you want some of that, right? To cut through that sweetness. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Mm-hmm. But get the hops off of there. People are like, well, wait a minute, but it's not going to taste all that great, so I'll have to leave it sit in there for longer. I said the extraction was done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is still acid hydrolysis going on, breaking these components apart. There's oxidation that has to happen that you want to do this. And yeah, some of those glutamates, those aroma bound glutamates we talked about, get cleaved during this aging process. So the beer hasn't developed its total aroma bouquet yet, but the actual chemical extraction in the solution is done. And if you do it at cooler temperatures, like, you know, 2 Celsius or something like that, it's like 48 hours. It's done. People are like, hey, I leave my dry hop sit on this beer for 2 weeks.
Yeah, why? I've gone through, like, in my brewing career, gone through those stages. Like at Hardywood, God, I don't remember. I think even maybe Left Hand, and even in the beginning of Noda, they were dry hopping at 50 degrees, 55 degrees, like coming down. And it probably wasn't even until I started really working at Noda where all that really changed, and we went up to 74 degrees. And that's what I do now as a brewer. But like, there was a time in just like everyone's practice. Like I even come across brewers still who will, they talk to me about this hop creep. Hop creep is weird to me because I always leave my fermentation open when I dry hop. Like I don't cap it off. And I think that might be the problem. They're just keeping it in there. I've just never had this hop creep problem before. Like, yes, obviously if you dump anything into a fermenter, it's going to agitate the yeast and get it going again. But I've never had like a problem from it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So hop creep, and again, all things old or new again, people were writing about what we're calling hop creep in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a thing that we knew about. We didn't know why it was happening. And we have a much better understanding now because of the exploding bottles and blah, blah, blah. And I was skeptical, still am a little skeptical of people's claims of hop creep being the result or being the problem of their manufacturing woes. I think it probably has more to do with poor practice. But we do know, without a doubt, that hop creep does occur. And the reason it is occurring, we believe, again, we've had 2 or 3 research projects that have shown this, is that hops have an enzyme in them that is able to cleave some of these branched sugars that other yeast can't cleave. And so once these enzymes clip those sugars, now those sugars are available for yeast to consume to continue fermentation. Oh. So one of the interesting aspects of that, and something I'm very curious about, but I haven't found any collaborators yet, is to understand how hop drying temperature impacts the activation of those enzymes.
Oh, interesting. So
high temperature drying, does that inactivate those enzymes? Whereas my low temperature drying, yeah, it's got more aroma, but your likelihood to have those special enzymes be active to cleave those branch sugars could be higher. Don't know. Total speculation, but something that we need to look at. Hop creep does happen, and it's especially prevalent in beers that are over dry hopped. If you're dry hopping in that 1.5 to 2 pound per barrel range, you're not likely to see it. But those people that are just going ape shit with their dry hops are more likely to find it, because the enzymes are there in very tiny amounts, very, very, very small amounts. So it takes a lot really to cleave a bunch of these sugars that might be floating around in there. What's that?
That would make sense. Why I don't have any problems with it.
Yep. So that's the skinny on hop creep. Again, it's the boogeyman of the day right now. So everybody wants to point their finger at, you know, hey, this is why my beer exploded, or this is why this went bad. Hop creep. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I don't.
Right. One thing I think a lot of, and not calling out anybody who's been mentioned on this recording today, but I think that a lot of brewers, so the ones who are really making the New England IPA styles well, they understand most of the science. They are technical brewers who understand what this is. And so many people who are producing a hazy IPA now don't know. And I know that I think all of us from personal experience can attest to the fact that there are a lot of breweries where people thought it would be fun to open a brewery. It's a retirement project. You know, their buddy in their neighborhood thinks they make good beer and wants to invest.
My mom likes my beer.
Exactly. So there are a lot of people who kind of read these recipes and don't understand you have to have all of those considerations to make it well. And sometimes it turns out okay, and sometimes it doesn't. And I don't know if you guys, did you guys watch Arrested Development?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you know how no one in the Bluth family knows what a chicken looks like? Uh-huh. That's New England IPAs today, yep. Where it's a nice bunch of people being like, cook, 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 cook. Like, you know, they just don't.
Yeah.
It's just all a bastardization of bastardizations, and you know, no, people are rarely getting the correct one.
I went to a bar and asked if they had any IPAs that were not New England, and the guy was like, aren't all IPAs New England these days? And I was like,
burn it down.
Yeah. And it set the building on fire.
They didn't even have, they had like all their tabs for New England IPAs anyway. Yep. So I was just like, oh my God, I can't. Yep. He was dead serious.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know.
Yep. Well, that's the, and Jen, we had the same problem in the hop industry about 10 years ago. It's definitely not as prevalent as it was, but we called them. I wrote this blog post about the five kinds of hop growers that were out there at the time, right? And one of them was the fat cat, which, you know, is like, I've got this money. I'm going to come in here. I'm going to be the biggest splash on the block because, you know, I'm a businessman. Like, if anybody describes themselves as a businessman or a businesswoman, like their primary, like that's who I am, I go the other way.
Yeah.
Because nothing good's going to come of that. Mm-hmm. But we have the same problem. Or it's like, I've got a quarter of an acre in my grandma's side yard. I'm going to be a hop grower. And they end up cluttering the space. Mm-hmm. And it becomes one more thing you have to, I guess, differentiate yourself from. Yeah. And just, yeah, it's exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah. As a brewer, you end up not trusting what you get locally. And one of our stories true story was a grower who, you know, knocked on the back door of a brewery with a garbage bag with their hops in them and said, would you buy my hops? And that is our cartoonish example for how not to sell to a brewery. But it happens.
Yeah. All the time.
It happens on the malt and barley side too.
Yep.
And that's really hard if you're the one who's doing it well. That's really hard to come back from, because you just paid a premium price, more than what you would normally pay for your raw ingredients, and it didn't work out well, because as brewers, you're also used to consistency and reliability, and you maybe don't understand. I know with the malt and barley side, teaching somebody that you may have to, you know, you need to look at the certificate of analysis. And if your protein's higher, you need to make some sort of, you need to make some sort of adjustment. Maybe you need to adjust your mill. And a lot of people aren't used to having to do that. Mm-hmm. And somebody comes in, you buy that premium product, it doesn't perform the way you want to, and maybe the beer gets dumped. You're never going to buy from a craft maltster or a small scale grower again, ever, because it was a very expensive mistake that you learned.
We say that, and we usually around the concept of local, we tell our growers, I'm like, local might get you your first sale, but it definitely won't get you your second.
That's excellent advice.
It's unfortunate, but it's true. I mean, I've been there. I've done the specialty small batch thing, and I just don't have the time a lot of the times. Like, it's unfortunate where I can't really afford to, like, I mean, if I buy some malt, I'm buying like 4 or 5 beers worth. Mm-hmm. That's like, I don't really have a bunch of stock, because I get my base malt pre-milled because I'm so small.
Yep.
So it's hard for me to, sometimes I can't buy from local because I just need the care foam, and I need a bag of rice hulls, and I need some gypsum, and the big guys got it, and I don't want to pay twice for shipping.
Right.
And it's not their fault. By any means. So when I can, I try, but there's definitely like, I had a more focused on local in the beginning, I think, than I do now.
That's part of that, but it's also the responsibility of that craft maltster or small scale hop grower to realize that and try to remove those barriers for you.
Yeah.
It's not just you, right? No, it's not. Right. So I remember back in the day when we were running our workshops, we would have one of our good brewer friends, kind of a legendary lager brewer up here, Kirby, old white haired ponytailed hippie guy, craft brewing back in the 80s. And he'd come in and he'd talk about buying local. And he's like, yeah, local's a great story. I'm not sure how I extract value from that. And I'm always interested in talking to you. He's like, but if it's growing in my backyard and it's shit, I don't want it.
Yeah.
Quality's got to come first. And that's the thing that small scale hop growers don't necessarily understand. They hear what you're saying. They're not listening to what you're saying.
Right.
They don't really know what that means until they're 3 years into it. And they're going to have a nervous breakdown because Mother Nature. And Rachel's still not happy with the quality that's coming in because you can't control it. Well, that's called farming. Right. So.
And there's a lot of people who still are learning how to brew too. So there's a lot of that. Like I might be having a problem, but it might not be because of the grower. It might be because of me.
Right.
And I'm, you know, not recognizing that, or like maybe they have someone who can help with brewing, maybe they don't.
Yeah.
So it's a tough barrier for sure. Cause it's a hard pill for a brewer to realize that they're not doing things right. And if you can get them to understand that, then maybe you have a chance, but then you're like also a dick if you say it in the wrong way. So it's like, what do? You know,
right. It's rarely the maltster's fault, but everybody likes to blame the maltster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's easier than blaming yourself for a bad job brewing. Like, oh, that malt didn't work out. I'm going to use something else next
right,
time.
Exactly. And,
you know, not my fault.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I get it.
So yeah, Greg, I think you mentioned you have a game for us.
Yes, I do have a game
that I've been
for
very
you.
Excited about.
So this is something we do called Beer the Name. And of course, you know, you're both at breweries, you put together a beer, and then you figure out what to call that beer. We decided to go in the other direction. We've got some names. And if this was on the chalkboard in your respective breweries, what would you have put into this beer? How would you have made this beer? And some of these have stories behind them. So this is one we use every time. A 9-year-old son of a friend of mine. We were first getting started with the podcast and we were about to have our first interview, and I was thinking of names for these, and I was out for a beer with a friend, and he told me a story about his 9-year-old who he overheard his 9-year-old saying this to another child. And this is the first beer I want you to create. And it's called, I'm going to punch you in the throat.
Okay.
We lost Rachel.
Yeah. No.
Oh, man.
She's already got ideas. She's like, I'm going to make a beer call. I'll punch you in the throat.
No, you know what? I was actually, I was just talking about punching somebody in the throat last night.
This is
a good one. Yeah, because I'm trying to now like walk back.
It comes up so many times a day. It's pretty.
You know, it really does. Mm-hmm. Ironically, it was an HR person. So that would have been like, extra bad. So
well, punch
I guess
them hard so they don't get back up.
Exactly. So in my context, if it's, I'm going to punch you in the throat, knowing that I was saying that about probably one of the worst positions in the world to say that about. So it's double worse. I think I would make it a double IPA. And I might go with something a little spicier, like maybe some like Chinook hops, maybe some Sriracha Ace, even though I don't really care for Sriracha Ace. And that's what I think I would do. It's maybe just like a kind of a classic West Coast double IPA with some like Chinook, some Sriracha Ace, make it just a little bit spicy. Maybe hop it just enough to actually get like a little bit of a throat burn, just as kind of an extra FU as it goes.
We'll just add on to that beer and just torpedo it over some ghost peppers.
Yeah, there you go. It's pretty common that this beer ends up with some sort of hot pepper in it, usually when we ask this question.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep, you need that throat burn.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I've got a couple here. As you both know, I've mentioned one of my favorite episodes of yours. You talk about going to beer festivals and things you hate about beer festivals. So this beer is called No Pretzel Necklace Needed.
All right. Rachel, I'll let you go first this time.
No pretzel necklace needed. So, no pretzel necklace needed. Man. Thanks for letting me go first, by the way.
Okay. I mean, I have an idea. I can go if you'd like. Okay. If you'd like some.
I've never stumped anyone before.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think of something funny, and I can't really think of anything funny. I'm like,
oh, it doesn't have to be funny.
No. And like, I don't need the pretzel because it's got my salt, you know?
That's kind of the direction I went in. So if, as a traditionalist, when it comes to pretzel necklaces, they are there to cleanse your palate and to cleanse your palate only. That's the only purpose they have. So if I'm saying no pretzel necklace needed, then I would go for something very refreshing and very light so you could drink it and it would refresh your palate so you did not need that pretzel. So again, calling in the kind of the pretzel aspect, I think I would do just something like a Gosa, maybe even actually something like a Lichtenhainer. Although I guess if I were doing a Lichtenhainer and I wanted to add a little bit of salt, then it would just be a smoky Gosa.
Yeah.
So I think I would do that and just make it just a traditional, nothing added to the Gosa, where it is its sole purpose is to have a little bit of that acidity, a little bit of that salinity that is going to also be light enough that if you're someplace like a beer festival, you could use it as a way to refresh your palate without needing a pretzel necklace.
I want that beer.
Yeah,
I'm
like,
technical answer. Yeah.
All right, well, let's see.
What else you got?
I got another one here. Now, again, and I did go back through your catalog as I was putting these together. We know that in addition to doing a podcast, you're also basically a book review forum for a single book that you've talked about many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with that in mind, why can't we all just get a lager?
Well, of course it's going to be a lager. It's going to be a Helles lager.
Helles?
All right.
Yeah, why not? Because that book is great. Have you guys read that book?
I don't know if you've heard of this book, but yeah. Rachel and I are big fans.
They also have it on audio book, if that's your thing.
Oh, okay. Well, that might be better.
Yes, that might work for me then. I've not read it yet.
It's like a story, you know? timeline for you.
But
you
I feel know. Like I've read the whole book already based on listening to
it. Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, I think I would go with a Vienna lager. For one thing, I just love that story about Gabriel Sinelmeyer and Anton Dreher. But of course, I'm going to go with something that's very malt forward. And I think that something like a Vienna lager is going to showcase something like, obviously, Vienna malt. In a very nice way that goes back to what Rachel and I have talked about and what we were talking about at the beginning of this episode, is you don't need to throw a lot of shit into a beer to get those flavors from it. You can have a very kind of deliberate, well-made beer if you really know your ingredients, your raw ingredients, and you know what those flavors can do. You can take a little bit of time and create a very beautiful complex beer that can still be basically a smash beer. So I think for my can't we all get a lager, it would be a Vienna lager.
Yeah, I like that one.
Nice. So on the opposite side of not throwing a lot of shit into a beer, what would you do with Pixie Spit?
What?
Pixie Spit. That I think that just calls for something like a Gosa, doesn't it? You know, like it's kind of acidic.
With glitter, though. You gotta put glitter in it.
Well, yeah, of course. but you know, it lends itself to things like glitter and things like I don't know. I feel like pixies probably eat like a lot of fruit, maybe. I don't know.
A pixie,
like a fairy.
Like a little fairy, yeah.
A pixie stick.
Spit.
Oh, fairy spit?
Pixie spit.
Yeah, pixie spit.
Is this a term that you guys have all heard before or something? Because I'm very much in the... Okay. You're just rolling with it better than I am.
Yeah.
Okay. No. I just thought I was out of the loop. I needed some clarification.
That's where I usually live.
Yeah, but I do. I feel like pixies probably have a very sugar-forward kind of processed goods sort of diet. So, I would think something that lends itself well to being very bright and kind of acidic.
Lactosey.
Yeah.
So some wine, sure.
All right, last one, and we keep going farther and farther off the reservation with these. What would you do with redneck bar fight?
That would be a bunch of adjunct lagers all mixed together.
That is 12%.
Yeah.
Nice. Like the 12-year-old at a wedding reception drinking out of everybody's glasses.
Yeah. With some White Claw.
Lit on fire. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's chaser. Definitely the White Claw. Yeah.
Imperial lager dashed with White Claw.
Nice.
The White Claw chaser.
Yeah. Helps with the presentation.
Couldn't hurt. I mean,
that's true.
All right, that's what I've got. Thank you for playing. That was I want to try the Smoky Goza. I do.
Yeah, I'll see what I can do. I happen to know someone who really enjoys brewing and drinking smoked beers.
Nice.
Very good. Well, this was fun.
Yeah, we've made it through. I think 3 of 15 talking points. So
that's the time, right?
that is what tends to happen. It just means we have to do it again.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Super fun.
Yeah. Very good. Well, thank you guys very much for reaching out and then continuing to follow up with us. It's definitely something that we had talked about doing for a while. And like I said, even just the two of us trying to find time to be able to record is sometimes a Herculean task. So we definitely appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you guys. Hopefully each one of our audiences, you know, learned a little bit about the other audience, the other podcast. And I definitely encourage all of our False Bottom Girls listeners to tune into Hopnology and, you know, learn everybody. I think most of our listeners and probably most of your listeners as well are here for the education and to be delivered that information in an approachable and fun way. So hopefully all of our listeners kind of blended together in this crossover special, and we'll definitely continue listening to both podcasts.
Oh yeah, and same goes here. You know, for both of our audiences, you know, reach back out, let us know if you liked us, if you want to see us doing this again together as a group, and you know, always trying to bring new and different perspectives to what's going on. Although I think we have a lot of similar perspectives. Which makes
this so fun. Yeah, I think we're all very good at seeking out people who agree with us. We've done a good job with it.
Can you boil it all down to I like this, the rest of you can go to hell? Is that kind of what it comes
basically,
down to?
Yeah, basically so. So yeah, Greg and James, if our listeners wanted to find you guys on social media, on podcasting platforms, where would they find you?
It's hopnology.com is our website. We're on Instagram as Hopnology. And I know it's not a real word, which is a little bit hard to find sometimes. It's Hopnology. We created a scientific term and threw hop in front of it because we thought that would be cool.
And I'm good at making up sciencey words.
Yeah, he is. A lot of them are just complete BS.
Yeah.
And to find the two of you, it's False Bottom Girls on both on Instagram and, you know, wherever your podcasts are sold.
Right. Exactly. Yes. We're False Bottom Girls on Instagram. We're also on Facebook. And you can reach out to us at falsebottomgirls@gmail.com.
Nice. When the zombie apocalypse is over, I might bring Greg to, you know, the brewery. And as long as he promises not to be the uninvited guest.
I love just walking up behind people and going, oh, you should try this one. You should try this one. I'm engaging that way.
Right.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Thank God we have sit down rules now.
Yeah.
Keep Greg in his little box.
Yep, over there. Don't talk to him.
I was just talking about punching somebody in the throat last night.